Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the fourth program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation today is constitutional crisis. They're watching. Mass surveillance constitutes a threat to free speech. Commercial and government surveillance infrastructure has grown and continues to grow, encompassing license plate readers, location tracking, and facial recognition and other biometric data. How do these invasions of privacy threaten free speech, and what protections should individuals and civil society adopt to protect civil liberties? This show is pre-recorded on April 13th. Send your comments to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests. Cindy Cohen is the former executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and author of the book Privacy Defender. Welcome, Cindy.
Thank you. I am still the executive director of EFF, although I'm outgoing. And we have a new leader. Her name is Nicole Ozer. She's great. She's going to be taking over, but I'm still here for the moment.
Hannah Cyrus is the digital media librarian at the Bangor Public Library. She's a member of the Library Freedom Project, a network of values-driven librarians working together to build information democracy, something that we should all probably be working on. She joins us today in her personal capacity, not representing the library, but I think she'll have a lot to say anyway. Welcome, Hannah.
Thanks, Ann. Hi, happy to be here.
And then Cooper Quinton is a security researcher and senior public interest technologist, also with the Electronic Frontier Foundation Threat Lab, and a board member at Open Archive. Welcome, Cooper.
Hi, happy to be here.
All right, so let's get started. Cindy, let me put it to you first. What is the mission of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and what are you worried about right now in terms of mass surveillance?
The mission of the Electronic Frontier Foundation is to make sure that when you go online, your rights go with you. So our passion and mission is to make sure technology helps support people as it gets deployed. And that has gotten us into fights around mass surveillance for a long time, because it's been a goal of the government and originally, and now a lot of companies, to basically make spying on us the number one business model of the internet that then feeds the government. So I think that it's this mixture here is really our big concern, is that between corporate surveillance and government surveillance, we really are watched way too much and in way too many ways. And then when you add artificial intelligence, neural networks on top of that, it really becomes a very powerful tool for both governments and companies to, you know, have leverage over us and to take away our rights. I should back up a little bit. I think about privacy maybe a little differently than some people do. I think of privacy as one of the ways that people with less power can have protection from people who have more power. And that's both on the governmental and on the governmental side. So with each little bit of our privacy taking away, the people who have power over us get more power and we get less. So this has been something EFF has worked on since the very beginning. And I was lucky enough to be involved early on. But right now, the technological advancements have made it far more dangerous situation. And I think people are starting to see the results. In Maine, for instance, you know, you had an ICE agent who was basically trying to intimidate people who were engaging in their First Amendment rights to protest by demonstrating how, you know, that they knew where they lived. That's intimidation. It's the kind of thing that silences people. And it's a tremendously important story that we need to push back on if we're going to regain our rights.
You know, stuff has been in the public domain for a long time. People, you know, there were public records. We've had a bill in the legislature this year about making private where our legislators live. I mean, that information has been public for a long time, but it wasn't online. You know, now it's online and it travels so fast. Cooper, is there any such thing as privacy anymore, or are we all pretty much out there?
Yeah, there's absolutely such a thing as privacy. And it makes me a little bit sad when people boldly claim that there isn't privacy anymore, because I think it leads to privacy nihilism, right? It leads to us saying, well, I can't hide anything, so I better not do anything, right? And that has a chilling effect on speech and on what we do, and on whether we're willing to speak up for our rights or not. There's definitely still privacy, although there could be more. It could certainly be a lot better. But there are many ways to protect your privacy. There are encrypted messaging apps like Signal that let us have private conversations. There are, let me say, non-corporate or independent distributed social media things like Mastodon or Blue Sky that let us exist in sort of alternate spheres where we're not having to give our data to these companies to sell just to be able to connect with our friends and family. And there are a lot of ways that people are working on protecting their privacy, right? EFF has a browser add-on that I worked on a long time ago called Privacy Badger, which stops the creepy trackers that follow you around from site to site as you're browsing the web. Privacy Badger blocks those and lets you know about what's following you around on the web. So there are definitely things that people can do to protect their privacy. A lot of very simple steps we can take. Really, we do need more privacy overall. Like, one of the biggest problems is that we don't have any sort of federal privacy law, right? There needs to be an all-encompassing federal privacy law that protects our privacy. Something, you know, kind of similar in spirit, at least, to the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation in the EU. Some states have this. California, for example, has a pretty strong privacy law, but it can't just be piecemeal, right? We've really got to protect everyone's privacy. The bill that you were just mentioning is interesting, right? A bill that will keep the addresses of lawmakers from appearing online. Why not write a bill that protects everyone's address privacy, right? Why only lawmakers? Why not write a bill that protects everyone's privacy in general, not just their addresses? It's interesting to me that they only want to protect themselves.
There's so many things in what you just said that I want to follow up on, and then I'll ask Ken a question about the main privacy law that just went down in our state legislature. But first of all, I know people are paying attention to what you say, and you said something and Blue Sky. Was the name of that thing Mastodon? What was that that you said?
Yeah, so Mastodon is correct. The name is Mastodon. Mastodon is a decentralized social media platform. So there are there are many ways to get email. You could get your email through Gmail. You could get your email through, you know, Microsoft or AOL. It used to be that like you could get your email through your local internet service provider, right? Or you could run your own email. Mastodon is kind of a similar thing, but for social media. There are 1,000 tiny Mastodon servers that you could sign up. Or one big, you know, there's a couple of official ones that you can sign up on, and you can talk to anybody else that's on any other Mastodon server. So in this way, it's a social media that is not centralized, it's not corporate controlled, and it's not feeding your data to a surveillance capitalism machine that is taking that data to monetize it for profit, right? So it's your posts are still public, so it's not private in that way. But it's more private in that, you know, it's not owned by Meta, right? It's not being, your information is not being mined to sell you ads. An interesting model of what the future could look like.
There's so much to talk about. You know, one of the things was, you know, I think Cindy alluded to this, and maybe she would like to address this, but was the permeability between data that's collected by private enterprise and how that is shared with the federal government. And so how permeability, there's like not a boundary there. So what is known in the private sector is probably known to the government. How does that work, Cindy?
Well, it works in a number of ways. I mean, it works kind of very straightforwardly right now. We know that the number one purchaser of data from data brokers right now is the government. Just a couple weeks ago, FBI Director Kash Patel testified before Congress that indeed they are buying lots of information about Americans from data brokers, and they're going to continue to do so. So, you know, kind of the old-fashioned way they buy it. But then there are lots of techniques by which the government can force companies to give, or, you know, subpoena companies to get information about users as well. And some of those are some of the things that I talk about in my book, Privacy Defender, about various ways that we've tried to push back against mass surveillance. The way mass surveillance works is, you know, never that the government comes to us. You know, the government didn't come to all of us and say, okay, everybody give us your phone records, right? They didn't do that. They go to the phone companies and they get it en masse. So same thing with tapping into the internet backbone. They do it through the phone companies. They get the information from the services that we rely on. People sometimes ask me, you know, are you more worried about the companies having information about you or the government having information about you? And the answer, the honest answer to that question is no one's giving you that choice. That is, that's not on the table. It's not a thing that is being offered. The way that the government gets information is from the companies, and the companies collect it for their own purposes. And both of those are problematic, and we're not in a position to choose one or the other. So whether it's through legal process or through just straight up purchasing it, the government gets information about us. And of course, the government collects information about us too. This is a whole other topic. It's not really about surveillance, but, you know, we're increasingly seeing information that the government collects for one purpose, like IRS data, being given to ICE for their raids, or we've also seen Medicaid data be handed over to ICE. The other way that the government gets information from us is that we give it to them for one purpose, and they are increasingly taking the position that once they get it for one purpose, they can use it for other purposes. The Trump administration calls this knocking down data silos, but it really violates one of the, what we think of as one of the fundamental privacy principles that we should be standing up for, which is the idea that if somebody, whether they're government or a private entity, gathers data from us for one purpose, they shouldn't be able to freely reuse it for other purposes. It needs to meet a much higher standard, if at all. Before this called secondary uses, for obvious reasons, that information is collected for a primary purpose and then is used for a secondary purpose. And, you know, that's really one of the keys to, I think, regaining our privacy, is to really enforce an idea of no secondary uses of data, whether that's government or private entities.
And Cooper, you talked about, and of course, our whole show is about how this leads to infringements on free speech, but connect the dots for us. How does the government having all this data infringe on free speech, would you say?
I mean, what I was talking about was more that if people don't think that they have privacy, if people don't think that they have the ability to speak freely online without consequence, then they won't. This will dissuade people from going to protests. It will dissuade people from posting their political opinions online, lest they face retribution from, you know, local governments. It will dissuade people generally from participating in society. That is a consequence that we should not stand for if we care about free speech and the First Amendment.
Go ahead and embellish on that briefly, Cindy, and then I'll take a little station break.
I don't know if I can make that better. I think people did the right thing. I mean, the whole reason why, you know, the First Amendment protects the right anonymous speech is the idea that people who don't have privacy, who don't have some basic protections, are not going to participate in the public process. You know, that right grew out of the civil rights era, where, you know, the government of Alabama was demanding that the NAACP, which was not an organization that the government of Alabama liked, turn over all the names of all of their members, all of the people who supported them. The Supreme Court recognized quite clearly that that would create a chilling effect on people joining organizations that were standing up for civil rights. So it's intuitively correct that being watched makes people behave differently. And there's a reason why the law protects that as well. If we want to be self-governing, if we want to be able to organize to make change in our cultures and our societies and in our governments, then we need to have a zone of privacy that is protected.
Okay, I'm going to do that station break. And when we come back, Hannah, if you can, I'm going to ask you to talk about the data privacy bill that was in our legislature this year. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is constitutional crisis. They're watching. Our guests are Hannah Cyrus, digital media librarian and member of the Library Freedom Project, Cooper Quinton, a security researcher and senior public interest technologist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation Threat Lab, and also a board member at Open Archive, and Sidi Cohn, current executive director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and author of the book Privacy's Defender. This program was pre-recorded on April 13th. No listener calls are being taken. So, Hannah, we did have a bill, a data privacy bill in the legislature that I think the ACLU brought forward, and it went back and forth, was hard fought. What do you know about this, and did you follow it?
Yeah, I've been following this bill pretty closely. I believe it was LD 1822, an act to enact the Maine Online Data Privacy Act. It's a lot of acts and enacting in there. Last I read about it was maybe a week or two ago at the time of recording, and it had kind of stalled out. There have been a lot of competing bills related to data privacy, kind of getting debated, as you said, in the state legislature. This one was a better one, in my opinion. It was not one of the like industry written ones. It was an actual like data minimization standard, meaning that companies would have to collect the minimum amount of data necessary to actually provide the services and only collect data necessary to provide those services. And it was going along pretty well, but the most recent reporting I read about it was that a few key Democrats flipped their votes, and it's a little bit unlikely to pass at this point as the legislature winds down their spring session. So that was disappointing. You know, there had been various carve-outs for nonprofits and governmental agencies, and then, you know, for political campaigns, and there's been a lot of lobbying by big companies, Maine-based companies like L.L. Bean, to try to strike it down. So it seems like they may have succeeded this time, but hopefully it'll continue to be a going concern in a future legislative session if it doesn't pass this time.
Well, the interesting thing that I thought was that it was actually a bunch of small businesses that got together. I mean, a lot of Maine businesses pooled comments in opposition to it, saying that they really needed the micro-targeting to find their customers and to continue to be competitive. You know, so it was business interests that sunk it.
Yeah, I think that there's kind of a business fantasy that, like, if you only knew everything about everyone all the time, then you would be able to have the best results you could ever imagine. This is also something that I've heard in defense of the data broker that a bunch of cities in the Bangor area have been spending municipal funding on, called Placer AI. It's all about tracking where people are coming from and going to, and how much time they're spending in different businesses and locations in the Bangor area. And that has been largely justified by this idea, you know, it's being purchased as part of like economic development budgets, and same kind of argument that like, well, these businesses need to know all of this information in order to make decisions. So putting those business interests ahead of the privacy rights of citizens.
Yeah, interesting. Consumers go for some of this. Like, some of the surveillance that happens to us has to do with stuff that we buy or willingly subscribe to, like smartwatches. Yeah, I think I've heard the term luxury surveillance.
There's definitely a trend towards, as you say, luxury surveillance of objects that people can buy, you know, your Ring doorbell or your smartwatch, things that are monitoring you, and they're sold to consumers as providing useful insight or providing security and protection for you. And I think a lot of people are not necessarily aware of all of the ways that their data is being monetized. You know, it's not just being shown to them. It's also being captured by the companies that own these devices, that own the software behind them. you know, I tell patrons at the library all the time, if they have like a smart speaker in their house, I'm like, that's a corporate spy that you're paying to live in your house and listen to everything you say. And you can get utility out of it, but I think people need to be aware of what they're trading off when they're opting into those kinds of things.
I think a couple of things. You know, I love tech. I like technology, and I really think that we ought to be able to have these toys and not have to give up all these secondary uses, right? I think that that's really where the problem comes in. And, you know, the idea that we're giving it up with those checkboxes or, you know, by using this product you agree to, I mean, that just really does a lot of, it's really disingenuous, right? Now, most people are not, that's not really a fair fight. It's all slanted against you. So, you know, I don't know what that would do to the price of some of these technologies if they weren't able to do all this secondary tracking, but I think it would be useful for us to think about, you know, how we can do that. I also think with regard to these small businesses, I feel kind of sad because I feel like they're reaching to spy on us because the world that they're dealing with is somewhat unfair in terms of the competitive advantage that some of the big companies have against the little company. I think it's somewhat unfortunate that small businesses feel like they need to do more spying in order to compete with the bigger businesses who are spying on us. It feels like we're in a bit of a race to the bottom at this point. And I would love to see thinking of better ways to shore up small businesses than just, you know, spying better and more on their customers. I've also seen some of the data about this micro-targeting, and I think it gets oversold. I'm actually not sure that the extra edge that, you know, all of these slick salespeople are telling communities, and I know they also go to chambers of commerce and other kinds of places, are really borne out by people's experience with these technologies. And I think it's important to ask a lot of follow-up questions and have accountability if you're going to deploy stuff like this to really figure out, like, is all this extra spying actually getting you what you want it to do? Because the research I've seen is that it's oversold, you know, and I think that's really important because it's not like there's nothing on the other side. You know, law enforcement's going to come. They're going to ask for information about your customers. You know, with that old line, if you build it, they will come. Well, if you gather it, they will come as well. And so you have to think about what you're doing when you're gathering all this data, especially if it's sensitive data. You know, if you'd have told me a couple of years ago that, you know, a woman would go to jail for having a Facebook conversation with her daughter about helping her get an abortion, I would have told you, well, that's probably, you know, that's unlikely. It did happen. It happened in Nebraska just last year. So I think that people also need to think a little harder about, you know, this idea that it's just, we're just gathering up data. It doesn't have, we're gathering information. It really isn't, there's not a lot of downside risk to it, because I think we're starting to see both in the main case around the protesters, in a lot of the immigration sweeps, in things around reproductive justice, where the states have different laws. We're seeing that the people who can be the target of this kind of information being marshaled against them is moving, and moving quite quickly in unpredictable ways. So even if you think it's not aimed at you right now, I'm not sure you could rest assured that it's not going to be aimed at you or someone you love in the future.
Well, and I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Is the permeability of that data and the way in which government can get it, either by subpoena or by just buying it on the open market. And talk a little bit more about how the government gets the data and what they might do with it if they were politically motivated.
As you mentioned, one of the big ways that the government gets this data, and I think the most concerning way, is that they often buy data directly from the companies that are gathering this data. There's a product called PenLink that's being used by law enforcement and by ICE in particular. The company is called PenLink. The product that they sell is called Tangles, and then a subproduct of that is called WebLock. Tangles is a social media surveillance tool that law enforcement is able to use to scrape social media data from publicly available social media websites and possibly also private APIs. So all of your data from Facebook or Instagram or even Blue Sky or Mastodon, which I just mentioned, they're able to scrape all that data, or maybe in the case of Meta, of Facebook and Instagram, they may be able to use APIs. We don't know. But they're able to get that data and map out the connections between groups, between who's interested in those groups, the connections between those people, basically all of your social media, what we call a social graph, right? The connections between you and everybody else on social media. And they're able to make dossiers of, for example, who has liked anti-ICE web pages, right? Who has liked, you know, posts from No Kings, right? And use those for further investigation or just to decide on investigative targets. You also have this WebLock add-on for this software, which is a piece of software that is able to map the locations in near real time of millions of cell phones all over the US. WebLock works by getting location data from the advertisements that are shown in apps on your phone. Those advertisements, to work, they have to go through what's known as a real-time bidding process, where data about your phone, the location, your demographics, 42-year-old male in California, right? All of this is sent to what are called real-time bidding centers. And these are places where people bid on your eyeballs, right? They bid for the right to show you ads. But all that data is more or less publicly available. It's available to anybody with access to this real-time bidding center. And that's about, you know, potentially thousands of companies. WebLock is able to scrape this data and plot it on a map for law enforcement to then buy and see a map of where people are in real time. They can circle a specific area and see what phones were in that area. They can then drill down on a specific phone and see where that phone goes, you know, where they're at during the daytime, which might be their place of work, where they're at night, which might be their house, right? Where they spend maybe their evenings and weekends. This could be, you know, their third space, a lover's house, a friend's house, right? Anything like that. And this is all data that law enforcement is able to get without a warrant because they were able to buy it from these companies. And I think that generally this is the most troubling thing for me, right? Is this loophole in the Fourth Amendment where law enforcement is able to just buy this data. Like Cindy said, when people ask, what are you more concerned about, you know, corporate surveillance or government surveillance? Well, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Right? The pipeline goes both ways.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, a huge concern.
Yeah. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Cooper Quinton, security researcher and senior public interest technologist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation Threat Lab and board member of Open Archive. Also with us, Hannah Cyrus, who is a digital media librarian and a member of the Library Freedom Project, a network of values-driven librarians working to build information democracy, and Cindy Cohn, executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and author of the book Privacy's Defender. Hannah, we've had a couple of news stories floating around right here in Maine about this. Can you talk a little bit about the reporting from Holton and the privacy fight that's been going on there from what you know?
Yeah. So up in Holton, which is, for those who aren't familiar, like our other guests, a city of about 6,000 people in northern Maine, they used some ARPA funding to buy many security cameras installed all around the city that included facial recognition capabilities. And we do have a state law that prohibits facial recognition by government entities. So there was seemingly a couple of people in Holton who really led the charge against these cameras. And after a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests and, you know, attending various town city council meetings and complaining, managed to get the cameras taken down. I think it is still in the news as recently as of a few weeks ago of the folks who are suing the town again, because they say they're still withholding information about where that data that was collected with the illegal facial recognition has gone. So I think that's kind of, on the one hand, a disappointing story in that they decided to use $130,000 to buy security cameras when they could have given everyone in town $20. But encouraging in that it shows that, you know, even a small group of concerned local citizens can make a big difference in pushing back against this technology, especially when they have the added benefit of there being some legal protections in place.
I hate to ask you to speculate, but why would the town of Holton want that?
I don't know the answer to that question. I think that, you know, as Cindy was mentioning earlier, there's a lot of slick salespeople out there in data collection land that are very good at selling these kinds of technologies, both to those economic development bureaus and also to law enforcement, right? Law enforcement are another huge market for this technology. And it's sold under the premise that it's going to make things safer. This is true in the case of things like those security cameras. It's also true for automated license plate readers, which are another huge threat in terms of mass public surveillance. And I think that if you're a small law enforcement agency, again, that idea that you could be everywhere and see everything and know everything, and if only you knew everything, that would keep everyone perfectly safe, can be kind of an appealing fantasy.
What is the, is it Flock that's the license plate reader, Cooper?
Yeah, Flock is one of the big companies that is selling license plate readers right now. The other big company is Vigilant, which is owned by Motorola Solutions. That's the big competitor to Flock. Vigilant is actually the one that has a contract with ICE currently. Flock does not, although ICE is getting a lot of backdoor access to Flock from local law enforcement agencies.
Why does law enforcement find this attractive? I mean, I can get, you know, find having speed traps automated or picking people running red lights and stuff like that. I know people have gotten tickets that way. Is that what they're doing?
Well, they're doing a lot of things, right? What they say is that they need this to track down stolen vehicles or to, you know, look for, you know, a kidnapping victim or something like that, right? If, you know, if they have a specific car they're looking for that, you know, they say they could use this instead of a police chase. That is one way you could use this, but that would not require keeping the data around forever. What we're seeing is that a lot of these agencies are not developing privacy policies that, if they are developing privacy policies at all, they're not developing ones that are friendly to people's privacy. You could use this to track down a stolen vehicle without keeping a record of everybody's location for the next 6 months. And what we're seeing for how these are being used a lot of times is they're being used for what we've seen them be used to try to track down somebody who had an abortion or prove that somebody went out of state for an abortion. We're seeing that they are being used to assist ICE in deportation. We've even seen them being used in relation to protests in unclear ways, but most likely to track down who was at a protest or maybe specific people that were at a protest. Generally, these are being overused. Why police actually like them is because of, I think Hannah, you know, hit the nail on the head. It's because police think that if they only had access to all of the information all the time, if they only had access to where everybody has been for the last 6 months, that they could solve every crime on their docket. That doesn't seem to be panning out so far. License plate readers have been in pretty heavy use by law enforcement for several years now, and we haven't seen, really, as far as I know, a meaningful uptick in the number of cases which have been solved, right? But we have seen quite a lot of abuse and quite a lot of using these for reasons that I think most people would not agree with.
Mm-hmm. Cindy, what's the international scene? Like, is the U.S. different or the same? Have other countries had this kind of surveillance for a long time? For some reason, I'm under the impression that Great Britain has a lot of surveillance cameras around for whatever reason. Is it, like, are they more tolerant of this, or is this a problem internationally as well?
You're right that the UK was really leading the way in terms of this idea of, you know, surveillance as a means to safety. A lot of this got started during the Troubles, right, when they were having actual terrorist attacks in lots of places in the UK, and it really caught on. You know, I would say that at this point, it really hasn't been demonstrated in the UK. I mean, it's, you know, I think there's a few areas where it has been helpful with some petty crime. I think that there's actually, you know, some interesting research about like people interdicting potential suicides. Cameras are actually pretty helpful, but that's much more targeted and limited kind of surveillance than what we're seeing. It really varies a lot around the world. I would say that, you know, in general, the Europeans are pretty good about consumer privacy, and they have things like the General Data Protection Law that were referenced earlier, but they're really not better in terms of government surveillance and things like that. This is really a global problem, this idea that law enforcement around the world thinks that, you know, has long wanted to, you know, kind of have this minority report, you know, enemy of the state kind of science fiction ability to spy on everyone all the time with the idea that that would then make us safer. And it really hasn't turned out to be true in any significant way, but it doesn't stop the selling. And, you know, government doesn't help sometimes. Like the federal government will make a lot of money available to local governments to buy this kind of equipment. Or, you know, the problem that we have in San Francisco where I live is like rich billionaires keep buying this equipment and handing it to law enforcement. So,
seriously.
Yeah. In San Francisco, it's crypto guy. You know, we really do need to step back. I think this idea that we can surveil ourselves to safety is really a false story. And it really is going to take, I think, people stepping back and saying, we don't want our money, our tax dollars spent on this, and we want our rights. And, you know, it's not surprising that law enforcement wants every single tool available to them all the time to do their job. The entire Constitution was written to say, well, here's what you can't do. Right. The Fourth Amendment. That's what that is. The First Amendment. You can't do this. So I think that we have seemed to have lost a bit the ability as a society to say no to law enforcement. And believe me, there are plenty of companies that want to come in and take advantage of that and sell technology to our governments and our law enforcement. And AI is on the way. I mean, the ALPRs and all of this stuff was, you know, and some of this stuff after you know, kind of the immediate post 9/11 attack, there was a lot of surplus equipment that got sold to law enforcement.
Okay, wait a minute. ALPR?
Automated license plate readers. So the Flock and Motorola stuff that we've been talking about, we call automated license plate readers. So anyway, it's something that keeps happening, this idea that technology that was developed for military purposes or other purposes gets offered on really cheap terms to local government. Of course, it's often the case that it's only cheap at first and it gets expensive later.
Yeah. And you were talking about a policy solution that Europe had. Just talk a little bit about that.
The General Data Protection Regulations, the GDPR, is a set of European rules around privacy that were passed a few years ago and provide a lot of protection for consumers in Europe against predatory surveillance. They also have, you know, there's a lot of click wraps. There's a lot of, you know, if you try to use European services, you'll get a lot more things you have to click through to get there. I think it has been good in some ways. I think it was still just a first step. One of the biggest limitations of it is that it doesn't restrict law enforcement surveillance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, you're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Hannah Cyrus, a member of the Library Freedom Project working to build information democracy, and Cooper Quinton, security researcher and senior public interest technologist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation Threat Lab and a board member at Open Archive, and Cindy Cohn, executive director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, author of the book Privacy's Defender. I want to talk in the last quarter of the hour here about what people can do. Yeah, so basically, what can be done? Hannah, what do you tell your people when they come up to you at the library desk and how do you tell them and advise them to protect themselves?
Yeah, I think there's two big buckets of things that can be done. And one is very individual of, you know, as Cooper was saying, there are tools out there for trying to protect your own information. I've got Privacy Badger on all the public computers at the library. And, you know, I help people on a daily basis, especially lately, more and more people coming in with questions about, all right, you know, how do I use Signal? Why is it better than regular texting? You know, what can I do? I'm worried about this piece of information or that piece of information. How do I get my information taken off of data broker websites? Those things are all possible. They require a lot of effort on the part of the user. So, you know, one strategy that I use with people who come in who are concerned about privacy online is an exercise called threat modeling, which is you ask yourself a series of questions about what information are you trying to protect? Who are you trying to protect it from? How likely is it you're going to need to protect it? How bad would the consequences be if you fail? And how much trouble are you willing to go through in order to try to protect it? It's almost impossible to protect everything from everyone all the time, unless we want to, you know, throw our phones in the river and go live in the woods, which sounds great to me, but not feasible for all of us.
I was going
to
say there was that guy, but go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, in Maine, that is an option. But yeah, so, you know, really trying to help people prioritize what is the top priority and how much trouble are you willing to go through to make that information more protected. And I think a lot of people are waking up to the fact that they have information that they really do need to take some more steps to protect than they used to, because that likelihood of needing to protect it is going up, and the consequences if you fail to protect it are getting worse. So doing, you know, steps like installing an ad blocker, switching to different services that are more private for email or texting, those can be good solutions depending on your privacy needs. And then the other big bucket is the more sort of civil, social, big picture stuff of, you know, talking to your legislators, talking to whoever is representing you in the state legislature and saying, I was really bummed that that Data Privacy Act didn't pass. Can you please push harder for that next time? And going to, you know, city council meetings, if you hear that automated license plate readers are being put in your area or data brokers are being purchased with municipal funding, local level things like that, people can make a really big difference with a small number of people.
Yeah. Do you want to add to that, Cindy? I know your time is limited, so I want to make sure you get in here before you have to get off.
Well, I think Hannah gave a very good list. And I think the last thing she said is really important, especially for places like Maine, because it really is true that not very many people pushing hard can have a pretty big impact on the local level. And I think that small community involvement, it doesn't take very much. You know, the higher up in government you get, the more people you need to make their voices heard to make change. That's the bad news. The good news is the lower you are in terms of locality and things like that, the less people you need. So I think that's really important. And I think, you know, she's right about, you know, there are some technologies that people use, thinking about it as a threat modeling exercise. How do you think about your own risk is right. And honestly, though, I think one of the things I hear sometimes is that, what can I do to protect myself kind of has buried in it the idea that you can protect yourself if you just set the settings right or use the right tools. And I think we really do need policy and legal and technological, better policies, better laws, better technologies in order to actually get to the place where we'll really have privacy. We can't do this with just one piece alone, and we can't do it alone. You alone with your own settings and your computer are not going to be sufficient. We have to make some changes that are bigger.
I see you nodding along, Cooper, so jump in. And I know a lot of my friends have moved to Proton Mail. Like, is that a thing?
I would like to answer both of those things. Hannah and Cindy really already said it all, but I'll just, you know, I think a lot about the parallels to the environmental movement. And a lot of people who've been in the environmental movement a long time will tell you is that, like, yes, it's great to recycle and use low wattage light bulbs, and we should all be doing that, but that is not the long-term solution, right? This is not an individual problem. This is a systemic problem, and we can't stop global warming simply by all just using low wattage light bulbs, right? We need governmental change. We need corporate change. We need economic and systemic change, right? And we can all while doing our individual solutions, really push for that, because that, you know, that is something that corporations like. They like to shift the problem back on us, right? Facebook likes to say, well, if you have a problem with your privacy, simply go into the five menus deep of your Facebook settings and click all of these obscure things, and then you simply won't have a privacy problem anymore. When A, that is not true, and B, Facebook could make those changes. They could protect people's privacy, and they choose not to. Right? They could make privacy the default, but they choose not to because it's better for business if they don't. So yeah, systemic change is, you know, both are absolutely needed, and systemic change is really the only way we get out of this issue we're in. On to Proton Mail. So it is certainly, so what Proton Mail does is it encrypts your email in your account so that only, like, the only way you can see the contents of your email is when you log into your account. But email in general is not encrypted. If you're emailing a non-Proton Mail user, that email won't be encrypted in their inbox. It won't be encrypted as it's traveling over the internet. And we know that large government agencies like the NSA like to slurp up anything that's unencrypted, especially if one of those parties is sending it from another country or potentially resides in another country. Proton Mail also is not your friend. They are still a corporation. They are not going to go to jail for you. They recently gave up payment data about one of their customers in response to a mutual legal assistance treaty request from the FBI to the Swedish government, where Proton Mail resides. It is probably more privacy protective in many cases than something like Gmail for some, you know, for some threat models. On the other hand, especially activists tend to consider it a magic bullet that will automatically protect all of your privacy, and that is very much not the case. So yeah. I want people to be a little bit skeptical. And you know, I mean, I think that Proton Mail's advertising really has not helped this, right? Like they have a interest in advertising themselves as completely secure and private, when that is not entirely the case. But it's a hard nuance to get across in just a couple of minutes, unfortunately.
I'm going to like sort of underline and highlight the thing that you just said. They will not go to jail for you. You know, if the government subpoenas them for my information, do they have to tell me?
It's a really good question, and it depends. So EFF had worked for many years to get the major tech companies to promise that they would give you notice if the government came knocking and asked for information about you. There are exceptions under national security and other kinds of exceptions, but in general, a lot of companies were doing that. We have recently, just in the last couple of months, discovered that the federal government was using a kind of administrative subpoena to get information about people from Google and a couple of other companies, and the companies were not giving people notice beforehand. And we're raising this issue with authorities pretty soon because they can't, on the one hand, promise you that they'll give you notice, and on the other hand, not do it. There's actually a legal problem there. So the answer is this is something we need to continue to push for. We've gotten a long way. In many situations, you will hear from a service provider if a government comes and asks for information about you, and we need to push to make that more the norm and not the exception.
All right. So what do we need to know that we don't know? Is there any sort of last bit of this topic that we have not excavated before we start winding it up?
I guess the one thing I would try to say is that sometimes you get to this part of the conversation and you can really feel overwhelmed and you can feel powerless, and that, you know, even a choice, you know, that you might think was a better choice might be more complicated and not as good as you had hoped. And I hear all of that, and I think it's really important. It is why we need a comprehensive privacy law. You know, it's privacy right now is if, like, you know, you went to the car dealer and they sold you a car, and then you had to go separately figure out how to pick out the brakes and the turn signals and the tires. And, you know, that's not how we want a fully functional privacy protective internet, and we're going to need law and policy to do that. The bad news is that's a thing we have to do. It's not going to magically come to us. The good news is, as a country, we've solved much harder problems. than this. I still think we can do it. And the other good news is you get to work with a lot of cool and amazing people if you throw in to try to make the world better.
That's great. All right. Well, I guess we're ready to wind it up. So I'm going to just go back around the room one more time and ask for your parting thoughts, the thing that you want our listeners to leave the conversation with.
So I think what I just said leads into my parting thoughts, which is, you know, we are definitely in a time when we need to lean in to protect our privacy and to protect, you know, many of the values that that kind of the work that I do sits on top of, things like a judiciary that'll stand up for the Constitution and things like that. I think that we can do it. I'm seeing more efforts to try to stand up for our values than I've seen in a long, long time. And I think it's worth doing and it's important. And I also, the other thing I maintain is that the good guys throw better parties than the bad guys. So it's always more fun to feel like you're part of the, you know, part of the people who are making the world a better place. So it can be fun. It can be exciting. It can be enjoyable, but we really do need to do it in order to stand up for our rights and really keep a hold of the idea of a self-governing country. And I really think that protecting privacy is a piece of that story that's important and worthy of protection.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Cindy. I know you've got to get off. Appreciate the conversation so much. Cooper, parting thoughts from you?
Yeah, I mean, fairly similar along the lines of Cindy's, but I'll say that I really hope that people don't succumb to privacy nihilism, right? Our privacy is not dead. This fight is not done. We can still have privacy. We can still have freedom of speech, right? And we do still have those things, even in the face of surveillance, right? Some risks are worth taking. And what risks are worth taking for you are going to be different than the risks that are worth taking for me, right? But you might look, you know, one might look at the surveillance that law enforcement has bought and say, you know, I don't think it's worth it to go out to that protest, right? I don't want law enforcement spying on me. Or you might draw the conclusion that, you know what, I don't care. Who knows? I was at that protest. I want to be at that protest. I want to have my voice heard, right? I want to go to the ballot box. I don't care if somebody's going to be there to try to intimidate me. It's important for me to make my voice heard, right? And I think it's important for us that care about this to continue to fight back against these, right? Just a couple of people can make magnificent change and significant change if they go out and fight. So I think it's important for us to continue fighting for this, to make that systemic change that me and Hannah and Cindy were talking about. And you know, really take back our right to privacy.
Much appreciated, Cooper. Thanks for those remarks. Hannah, the last word to you.
Yeah, I agree with everything that Cindy and Cooper said. I think it's true that more and more people are kind of waking up to the urgency of protecting privacy rights in this moment. I also try to fight against privacy nihilism, and I think it becomes easier once you see the real-time consequences, like some of the examples that we've cited during this conversation. People who are just trying to go to protests or trying to live their lives without being kidnapped off the street or trying to go get an abortion, right? These are things that, regardless of, you know, your political leanings, if those things are legally protected, then you should be able to do them and talk about them without fear of reprisal from the government. And I think I see people on a daily basis coming in to the library, people from all walks of life who have concerns about this, whether it's on the level of, I just want to make sure no one's getting into my bank account, all the way up to, you know, I'm a local organizer and I'm worried about surveillance from the police. And there are steps that you can take. And it is about protecting more than just yourself. You know, we don't want to live in a society where it's just understood that no one has any right to privacy. Yeah. Because we're seeing what the consequences of that can look like when it comes to free speech. So I encourage people to You know, take these issues seriously, even if you think that you personally have nothing to hide and your life is an open book. Think about what the world would look like if anyone could know anything about everyone.
Yeah. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you to our guest this afternoon, Cindy Cohen, the Executive Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and author of the book Privacy's Defender. Cooper Quentin, security researcher and senior public interest technologist, also with the Electronic Frontier Foundation Threat Lab, and a board member at Open Archive. And then Hannah Cyrus is a digital media librarian and member of the Library Freedom Project, a network of values-driven librarians working together to build information democracy. We love those librarians. We've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM, streaming at WERU.org. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@WERU.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to learn about other shows in our series. You can subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next month.